Yes.
So much of today, but probably not all of today, will be taken up with introducing a little bit more of logic and, in particular, more proof automation.
Now I need to focus. Yes.
And we start by extending our language with more symbols. And so we start to learn about more logical formulas.
Has really
This is impossible. I mean, this audiovisual equipment is just crap. What is this? So here you see the syntax of formulas. In addition to the equality that we had already used quite heavily, we have parentheses, of course, we have negation, conjunction, disjunction, implication, and quantifiers for all and their exists. And the order in which you see them on the slide is intentional. That means the earlier operators, like equality, bind more strongly than later operators. In particular, the AND binds more strongly than the OR, which binds more strongly than the implication. That's the standard, this is the standard convention for logical operators. And here is an example of this binding power. You have, when you write this, it's implicitly read like this. Why? Because of those three operators, not, AND, and OR. Not is the first one in this list, so it binds most strongly. So the NOT is just applied to the A. Then comes the AND in the list. So AND binds slightly less strong than NOT. So you have the AND like that. And then finally the OR. That's the weakest of the binding operators. So you have to keep that in mind when you type logical formulas. And that's another one to keep in mind. The equality binds most strongly of all the operators. So if you write this, you don't need the parentheses. It's passed in the way you would expect it. But you may not always mean this. So if you write inequality between two formulas, the formula A and B equals the formula B and A, then the system will parse it like this. So this is maybe not what you meant. If you really wanted to have the left and the right side grouped together, then you need to put in a parentheses, because otherwise the equality is the dominating operator and this the strongly binding one, which you can see here. And if you meant it otherwise, then you just put parentheses around the left and the right-hand side. And here's another example of binding power or precedence. The quantifier binds quite weakly, which means that here the AND has precedence over the quantifier, and the quantifier therefore groups all the way to the end of the AND. It's really the quantifiers are here the weakest binding operators, which means typically that the quantification extends as far left as possible, as far right as possible. And if you don't like equality because it gives you the maybe wrong precedence for Boolean formulas, then you can also write if and only if. And then that has the normal precedence, which is the same as the arrow. And then you could write that formula here with an if and only if in the middle, and then you don't need parentheses. But that's, yeah, fine-tuning. And here are some more conventions. If you have multiple variables that you want to quantify over, you don't have to write multiple quantifiers. You can just write a single quantifier. And similarly for existential quantifier and lambda abstraction. And finally, something that's really specific to the Isabel parser, if you have a quantified formula for all x something inside a bigger formula, then you do need to put parentheses around it. It's again like the if then else. It's a construct that has a starting keyword, but you don't know where it ends, and therefore, by default, you have to put parentheses around it. Of course, if it's just the formula, at the top-level formula, then you don't need the parentheses. But as soon as it occurs inside some other formula, like here, there's something else to the left of it, then you need those parentheses there. That's just something you have to get used to. And if you wonder how to type all those symbols, here's a slide that tells you how to do it. So on the left, you have the mathematical symbol, and then you have two columns of, or two ways of typing those symbols, the long way and the short way, typically. And you can use either. Then we already used sets last time. I will just recall them. So sets over basic type A, the type is written A set, as with lists, A list. And the constructions are the ones that you're used to from mathematics, except that the empty set is not written with a zero and a line through it, but it's written open parenthesis, close parenthesis, and if you just want to enumerate a set, you just use the usual set syntax. And then there are all the standard operators, element sign, subset sign, and so on, union, intersection, set difference, minus, and then a set means the complement of the set, all the elements that are not in the set. And finally, set comprehension can be useful. This is the set of all x that satisfy the property p, and the x has to be a variable. And there's lots more. In case we do need more, we will introduce it on the fly, but these are the standard ones that you should have seen in lots of contexts already. And if you want to know how to type the most important ones again, here are the symbols, and here are two different ways of typing those symbols. Typing the symbol, writing it. So that's sets, and yeah, that's really all in the way of language extension that I wanted to introduce. This is the syntax of formulas, and then we have the syntax of sets. And that's really the whole repertoire of logical symbols and basic set theory that we will need in this course. So now I want to get on to proof automation. Because as we saw last time, there is a limit to what we have seen with auto, and we can do a little bit better, and it's important to introduce that. So, recall we had SIMP. What does it do? It does mostly rewriting, and it does a little bit of arithmetic. And auto also does rewriting, but then again a little bit of arithmetic and logic and sets. So that's what they know about. The advantage of both of them is that they show you where they get stuck, and that gives you some hint what additional lemmas you may need, or what you may need to modify in your statement in order to complete the proof. Unfortunately, the ones that we're talking about today won't be quite as nice as this, but they'll be more powerful. So the disadvantage, they're highly incomplete, so there's lots of stuff they can't prove, and although it is provable. And they are both extensible with new simplification rules. We've seen that. And the one difference here is really auto is in a special class. It acts on all the subcodes rather than just on a single one, the first one. So that was just recalling what we had seen already. Now, fast force is a new addition to our repertoire, and it also knows, it seems to know about the same things as auto. It knows about rewriting logic, sets, relations, a bit of arithmetic, but in some sense it tries harder. So that's the main difference. So it's also incomplete, but it does it can do a lot of things that auto can't do. The main disadvantage is it really succeeds or fails. So it doesn't leave anything behind and doesn't give you any hint if it fails, why it failed. That's the main difference to the other two methods, SIMP and auto. And it's also extensible with new SIMP rules in the same way that SIMP and auto are. And then there is yet another proof method called BLAST. And that one is, at least theoretically, although not in the implementation, it's complete, a complete proof search procedure for first-order logic. So anything that's pure first-order logic should be provable with this. But this isn't actually terribly much. So this does, for example, not include numbers, and it also doesn't include equality. So BLAST knows very little about equality. BLAST will hardly do any rewriting. So for this course, it's typically not that useful because we'll be using, because we're dealing with functional programming, so there's a lot of rewriting going on. But in some situations where it's really just a matter of logic without equality, then BLAST can be useful. And it's particularly strong when you have just purely logical formulas, sets, and relations, then it does better than the others. And again, it either succeeds or fails. And it's also extensible in a way that I won't even show, I think. And finally, we have something called Sledgehammer, and that is a completely different beast. All the ones that you've seen so far, they're really, they have been programmed as part of the Isabel kernel. They're not part of the kernel, but it's part of the Isabel system, and they don't need any external help. Sledgehammer is a tool that relies on external help. So you have the following architecture. You have the Isabel system that you interact with, and at the back end, you have external automated theorem provers that other people have written. And then the Sledgehammer tool, what does it do? It takes a goal that you're trying to prove and then filters from the library all the lemmas that seem relevant for this goal and then passes them off to these external ATPs. And they will then go away for up to half a minute and try and solve it. And if you're lucky, they come back with a proof. And that proof will then be replayed internally in Isabel. And there's a whole little industry out there of people writing automatic theorem provers. And those are the systems that we plug into. And in fact, there's an annual competition of these systems, how well they do on a large database of logical formulas, lots of different categories. In fact, there's one category of problems generated from Isabel. And so we really have at our disposal the best systems around. And the characteristics, unfortunately, are sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. That's the situation. If you have an undecidable problem, then in practice, it'll sometimes, anything will sometimes work and sometimes not work. So you just have to try your luck. But that's the basic idea of how that system, that Sledgehammer system works. And before we get on to show you some examples, I hadn't introduced this yet. By proof method is just short for apply and then done. So that means you're claiming that this proof method actually finishes the proof because you're claiming afterwards done succeeds. And now I would like to show you some examples.
this? Okay. Is that large enough for the people in the back row? Good. Then let's...
So here are some simple examples from logic and set theory. The first one is the proposition for all x, there exists a y such that x is equal to y, and that's really quite simple. Auto can do that. The next one is related to sets, and if A is subset of B intersect C, then A must also be a subset of B union C, and again, auto can do that quite nicely. But there's a limit to what can be done by auto, and here is an example. Let me break the line here. What does this say? It says that all elements in the set A, for all elements in the set A, there exists, for all X's in A, there exists a list Y's, such that the X's is Y's append Y's. So basically this claims all the lists in the set A are of the form one list and again the same list. And then we have an element US in A, and now the claim is then there must exist a natural number such that the length of that US is n plus n. That's pretty obvious because since US is in A, it must again be of this form some list and again the same list, and therefore the length of it must also be the addition, the sum of the two lengths. And since it's the same list after one after the other, that's what this here tells us, it must also be the same length, n plus n. And FastForce can indeed do that, of course, with the help of a number of built-in lemma, not built-in, but a lemma library that is given to FastForce about lists. So this is just an example that delimits what how much auto can do, because if you were to try by auto, it wouldn't do it anymore. So this is just a cooked-up example to show where kind of the border is. And if you're wondering, well, do I have to go through all these different automatic proof methods myself? Not always, but what you can do is when you say you have some proof goal and you want to see do any of the automatic methods do it, then you can ask try zero, and then it will say there are trying lots of stuff, and then in the end it says, try this one worked. Now, this is a bit limited in the sense that it will only try these automatic methods without extending them with new simplification rules or new other kinds of extensions. So if, for example, simp would have worked, but you would need some lemma added to simp, then it wouldn't find it. So this try zero is helpful, but only it only calls the pure methods without any additional parameters. So, and here is a final example of this kind, an example that's here. You can read the text. It says that lemma here is another way, or a very detailed logical way of expressing this statement. If T is a total binary relation and A is an antisymmetric binary relation and T is a subset of A, then A is a subset of T. And instead of phrasing it in terms of sets, I have phrased it here in terms of binary relations. So the first line here, that expresses which property? Yep. Totality of T. For all X and Y, either in one direction, T must hold, or in the other direction. The next one is the antisymmetry, meaning A is antisymmetric, meaning that if the A relation holds for x, y, and for y, x, then x must be equal to y. The last one is T is a subset of A. I have now expressed here as this statement about the relation that if T of x, y holds, then also A of x, y must hold. So everything where T holds, A also holds, so A is the bigger one. And then A is a subset of T. Of course, that's just the converse of the line above, that if AXY holds, then TXY holds as well. So this is a very verbose way of expressing the very short sentence up here. And now this is really almost pure. It's pure logic, and there's very little equality in there. And this is something that BLAST can do well. And I think, for example, AUTO will not be able to do this. And I'm not even sure FastForce actually can do it as well. But it's one of those things that if you try to understand it yourself, you can stare at it for a long time without understanding why that should be the case. The proof isn't actually very hard, and it's an atypical example for this course. It's a purely relations theoretic statement. It's got nothing to do with data structures, but I just wanted to show you what kinds of things can be done automatically. And finally, a demo of the Sledgehammer tool, and I will show you the premium edition of Sledgehammer. So here is an example that I want to work on. This lemma that says the relation R, it's transitive closure. So this is this up arrow star is some built-in syntax in one of the basic theories for the transitive closure of a relation. That means a set of pairs, a binary relation. The claim is that R star is subset R union S star. And this is something that none of the automatic proof methods will be able to handle, none of the built-in ones like AUTO and BLAST and whatever. You can try it. If you say try zero, then it immediately says, how long had it been gone? Just now, okay, right. Yeah, come back. Okay. Right. Yes, so this was a failed attempt to find a proof, and it very quickly said no proof found. None of these methods know anything about relation algebra. And so I've picked something from the library that is not supported very well, because it's actually a bit tricky, by any of the standard methods. But that's where Sledgehammer comes in handy, because Sledgehammer really takes the full library that's there and selects the typically hundreds of possibly relevant lemmas, and then shifts it off to the back-end provers, which are part of the Isabel distribution, but we didn't write them. And then those will try and use those hundreds of lemmas to find a proof. And so this is the premium Sledgehammer. Yep, it worked. So it did find a proof, that proof you can now click on it. So if you go in the lower window and click on it, it'll be transported up there, and indeed it works. It is a particularly simple proof, but it's nice in that it's now found some lemma that you will probably not have ever heard of, It's called R-truncal-mono. What does it stand for? It stands for reflexive transitive closure monotonicity. So it tells you that the reflexive transitive closure, the star, is monotone. And then it begins to make sense. Why is that a lemma? Why is this true? Because R is a subset of R union S, and then by monotonicity, R star will also be a subset of R union S star. So it's not a particularly deep theorem. It's nice that the system could prove it without us having to go away and first study the library about reflexive transitive closure operations. And I'm sure it can do more than that. Any suggestions from you what we should try and prove about in this particular area of R star? Maybe there's also plus and not just star. So the transitive closure. Audience participation, make a suggestion. Yep.
R star union S star.
R star union S star on the left hand side.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's actually a nice one. Yep. Yeah. So that the separate closures are subset. Now, that here tells me that probably that lemma is already in the system. Let's look at the output window, and it says, yes, autoserve direct. The current gun can be sold directly with this lemma. But it's still, let's see if slash lemma can pick it up. I think it can. Yes. So here now it picks up that lemma, it found that lemma, and then it just uses the BLAST method to apply it. Of course, you may be wondering what happens if you don't have the premium edition. Well, luckily, there's the sledgehammer panel that you can use, and then you just click on apply, and it does the same thing. But it's not as satisfying as being able to wield the hammer and get the result. So, yeah, so that's one example. Here is another one. Again, I want audience participation. Here is a statement about lists or an assumption about lists that the list A cons X's is the same as the list Y's with the A at the end. And that should imply something. So you should now think of some property P that you think is implied by that, and then we will try and see if Sledgehammer can prove it. Yeah?
That X's and Y's consists, it's either M plus A star, and so it's either M plus on your base.
Right. So I think how do we best express this? That the set of elements is contained in the set A. Yeah, okay, this is what you probably mean. Let's just prove it for X's and subset. So I should really be using the subset. For subset, you can write this and it'll accept it, but just doesn't look very nice. So that's subset equal. That's what I mean. This set here, is that... That's what you're saying.
A star kind of, so... Yeah, I don't know. Does it generate the set of all...
Set of X's is the set of elements in the list.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you're saying all the elements are A's, and it could be empty. Yeah. Okay. Let's look at the output window because there's this blue button that came up and it said, I found a counterexample. And here's the counterexample, namely that yeah, you can read it. So they A and X's and Y's don't all have to be A's. They just have to, one has to start with an A and the other has to finish with an A, but in the middle you can have other things. So maybe some other property? Yeah. Right.
Y's equals ref X's.
Auto-quick check finder counter-example. So here's an example where X's is A prime A and Y's is A prime. So I mean, some non-trivial property follows from it, but I have to agree that when I was looking at this the first time myself, I came up with similar conjectures. So they're not ridiculous. Both of your conjectures are kind of plausible. Yeah?
X doesn't
end with
an A, and
Y start
with an A.
Right. So you're saying the x's, let's just take one of the two. So x's must end with an A, meaning x's, there is a sublist of x's. We don't need this. There exists, let's call it x as 0, such that x's is x as 0, and then the A at the end, right? Well, I'm surprised. So let's try a sledgehammer. I'm surprised it doesn't find a counterexample, because there is one. And a very simple, in fact, one. Pardon? Yes, so X's could also be the empty list. And so that's why we're not going to find a proof, but we could now try and augment our statement. So it now just says EZ3, CVC4, SPARS, those are all automated provers. They timed out, they didn't find a proof. And yeah, I'm really surprised that... of course... I'm not surprised that it didn't find a counterexample, because now we're getting beyond what can be done automatically, because here we're trying to prove a statement with an existential quantifier, and so if you want to disprove it, you have to show that that something doesn't exist, and since there is an infinite set of possible lists that could be witnesses, you would have to go through an infinite set to disprove it, and that's not easy. So that's why I didn't find a counterexample. But now let's try and say, okay, X is empty, or this statement. That's what you meant, right? Yeah. And now let's see. Let's have some with. And now it does find a proof, and now it's a bit more complicated, and you can see there are proof methods there that you've never heard of. So, for example, this one is maybe a nice example. Metis is, in fact, the standard proof method that Sledgehammer will use when it replays the proofs found by the external prover. So the external prover basically came back and said, I can prove this statement using these two lemmas. You can look at the lemmas. So append but last ID. What does that say? Oh, that's actually interesting. It's dragging in a lemma about functions but last and last that are not part of the statement at all. That is, sometimes it happens. It's unusual. Then it's also, what is this? Oh, last snock. It says last of X is append. Ah, yeah. Okay. So we can see there's some relationship. And in fact, the Metis method will only take those three lemmas and will try and find a proof based on those three lemmas. using some very refined version of resolution, essentially. We're not going there. That happens automatically at the back end. This is just some additional information for you. If you've heard about resolution, that's the method that the Metis the prover is using. So essentially what happens is the external provers find some proof, and the only information that they give back is the proof used this list of lemmas, and then Isabel tries to reconstruct that proof based on those lemmas. But the difference is the external provers had to find those three lemmas from among maybe 300 lemmas, whereas Isabel now just, in this line, we are giving it directly those three lemmas, so it's much easier to find the proof now that we're so focused on those three lemmas. Okay. Any more fun with Sledgehammer, or shall we move on? Up to you. Yep. I think that's probably not true. Some variation of that is probably true, but I'm not sure. Let's see. Set of X's equals set of Y's. That should be, if it's false, we should find a counterexample. And the fact that we haven't yet found one seems to say you're right. That's interesting. I've never thought about that one. I think that should be provable. Yep. So let's look at this one, for example. But it's a longer proof, so it needs 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lemmas. So, yep, nice one. I have to remember that one. And also we have this effect that it uses a lemma about rotation, which is a bit odd. Why does it need rotation? And if you look at the others, actually both of those provers found lemmas involving rotation. So it doesn't mean that these automatic proofs that you get are necessarily the simplest ones. But often you can then look at the lemmas that that are there, and if you have the time, then you can say, oh, I think I can actually get rid of some of them. Well, that's already tried automatically for you, but maybe it inspires you to give a different proof. But, okay, now really let's get back to the main line, namely, now we need to focus again. Yeah, proof automation, and now I want to talk about something that's actually quite relevant for this course, namely automating arithmetic proofs. Because once you start proving things about time, for example, execution time, you will be in need of performing arithmetic proofs. And the subset of formulas that where the proof is highly automated are called the linear formulas. What are linear formulas? They are formulas over numbers that consist only of variables, numbers, multiplication of numbers and variables. So that's just glorified addition, at least in the case where the numbers are whole numbers. And then you have addition and minus, but you don't have any multiplication between variables. So that's why it's called linear. And you have the usual comparison operators, equality, less than or equal, and equal, less than. And you have all the logical operators. The quantifiers depends a little bit. The story becomes more complicated there. But so let's just assume there are no quantifiers for a moment. And these are called linear formulas, and here are some examples. Here's an example of a linear formula. You see there's only the only form of multiplication we have is multiplication with constants, and otherwise we just have addition and the comparison operations and the Boolean operations. And here's an example of a nonlinear formula where you have multiplication between variables So that's outside the fragment of linear formulas, and that's something where automation is becoming more difficult. And then the linear formulas can be extended further, and I will call them extended linear formulas, where you also allow the minimum operation, the maximum operation, the even and the odd predicate. You allow diff and mod, but only diff and mod with fixed numbers. So you don't allow variable diff variable, but you allow variable diff constant. And also some conversion functions like conversion to natural numbers, the floor, the ceiling, and the abstract value function, absolute value function. So these can also be dealt with, and this is what the BI-ARIF method does. It automates the proof of, in fact, extended linear formulas. And like the ones that we've seen so far, like BLAST, etc., it succeeds or it fails, and it's a decision procedure for extended linear formulas. So if you have an extended linear formula, it's guaranteed to either prove it or fail to prove it, and in that case you know it's unprovable. But beware, these decision procedures are highly complex, and if your formula is largish, then it's quite possible that it's provable, but the system will just take forever to prove it. So it's not as quick as you might want it to be. And how does it deal with things that are not linear? It doesn't just throw them away. So if you have this formula that you want to prove, and you give it to the arithmetic proof method, then what that will do, it says, oh, I don't know about multiplication. I will just replace this subterm that's a multiplication by another variable u, and I don't know about the function f, so I will just replace f of y again by a new variable v, and then what is left to prove is this, and that's most likely not provable, so then it'll just fail. But it'll try to make a decent attempt at it, and so, for example, if you were trying to prove x is less or equal x times x plus x, it would be able to do it because it would just replace this by u, and then it would have to prove x less or equal u plus x, and yes, it can prove that. So it's sometimes helpful, so you don't have to, you can still try it if new symbols are in there like f or multiplication, but chances are it won't be very good at it. Then there's a second helpful method for proving arithmetic formulas, and that is the simplifier, where you feed additional simplification rules into the simplifier, and we had that already on one of the examples. Algebra simps is the list of algebraic rewrite rules, and in particular, it contains associativity, commutativity, and distributivity of plus and times, and essentially just multiplies out the formulas as much as possible. And is that one of you? And so the result will be that either it makes it simpler or even proves it, but it may also just, you may end up with a mess of a highly exploded formula that you can no longer recognize, and that means it just didn't help you, and you should probably not do that step and just look at the goal beforehand and try and figure out what's going on. And finally, there's also something called field simps. So those are simplification rules for fields, for Körper, so in particular the real numbers. That can be helpful because it also contains lemmas about division. and not just addition and multiplication. However, as you're well aware, when you deal with division, you have the problem that you have to know that something that the numerator is the denominator is non-zero in order to do anything with division, and so it can cancel common subterms. For example, it can reduce this to one, but it can cancel out the x and reduce this to y divided by z, but only if it can figure out that x is non-zero. And so that's if it's not part of your goal statement that x is non-zero, then it'll the field sims is not going to do anything here. It'll try to prove x is non-zero, but if that doesn't follow easily from anything else, then it's not going to be helpful for division. But you can always try it. And finally, there's something you should know about numerals. Namely, they are syntactically different from successor terms. So now we're talking about natural numbers. Everything I talked about before applied to integers, natural numbers, and real numbers. This, of course, is only natural numbers. So if you write down a numeral like 12, it is logically equivalent to 12 successors of zeros, but it's not the same thing. Therefore, if you have defined a function with the successor recursion pattern, and then you want to apply it to a numeral, it's just not going to work because the numeral isn't a successor. It's equivalent to one, but it's not identical to one. And so here's an example. The exponentiation function, some value to the n, where n is a natural number, which means just the n-fold multiplication of x with itself, that is defined by successor recursion. So if this is a successor term, sac of 5, for example, then it will unfold it once and you will get it's the same as x times x to the 4. But if you write down a numeral there for the n, then nothing will happen. So for example, if you write down x to the 2 and then you simplify that, it'll just stay x to the 2 because it's not x to the successor of something. And therefore, in some situations, you may have to convert those numeral terms into successor terms first before the function equations fire. And this is how you can do it. There is a simplification rule called numeral EQ suck. And if you add that to your simp autoproof command, then it will go away and rewrite the 2 to successor of successor of 0. Of course, you shouldn't be using this if you have a very large numeral in there, because then the successor term will just be gigantic and you will never get to the end of that. But in reasonably simple examples, this simp add numeral suck will actually work, and it will rewrite this term to this term, and then maybe some of the other arithmetic theorem provers, proof procedures can deal with it. So that's really the list of things that I wanted to tell you about that you may need to know at one point or another. The automatic proof procedure ARIF, the simplification methods of adding algebra simps or field simps, or adding this to get rid of numerals and replace them by successor terms. And now let's look at those in concrete examples. Let's first look at this. This is a simple example. This line, which can be solved automatically, and you don't have to understand exactly what the formulas say, but you can see it's a mixture. It does contain unknown for the arithmetic prover, unknown symbols like F here, but it can still prove it because it will just replace this F of X consistently here Well, I think it does it consistently. It'll replace all occurrences of f of x by some new variable u, and then this actually becomes a provable formula. And here's an example that is actually not quite so obvious. That says that every natural number greater or equal 8 can be written as the sum of 3s and 5s. So there are coefficients or numbers I and j such that k can be written as a linear combination of 3s and 5s. And that is also provable automatically, although it has a quantifier in it. So this is something called Pressburger arithmetic. I don't think it'll be very important for this course, but just in case you've heard of Pressburger arithmetic, this arith actually is an implementation of the decision procedure for Pressburger arithmetic. But again, this is highly explosive. If you have more than a handful of variable, it's not going to work because it's just the complexity is too high. And then here we have an example of extended linear formulas where we have the mod operator. And what does it say? If n mod 2 is 1, then n plus n mod 2 is 0. So it can deal with that because the 2 is a constant. If you were to replace this by a variable, the 2, then it just wouldn't do it anymore. And you could modify things a little, like instead of writing n plus n, you could also write, not 2n plus n, then it's no longer provable, then it's wrong. But you could write, say, 2n, and then it's just as provable. So those were examples where arith could do it on its own. The next one is something that arith will not be able to do. Why not? Why is arith not going to handle this one that says I plus j times I minus j is I squared plus j squared? Why is arith not going to do this? What's the problem? Yes, that's precisely. Yeah. And so here, this is simple enough that just simplification with algebra sims will do the job. And finally, just as, to show you that mere evaluation of formulas where there's no variable and just numerals are in there, that can be done automatically, like here, 5 to the 2 is equal to 20 plus 5. That is just by simplification. So here, if everything is a numeral, then expressions get automatically evaluated. You don't need to convert them into successor form. But if you were to prove something like this, lemma, what was it? X to the 3 is equal to x times x times x. And let's fix the type, otherwise things may go wrong. For example, real, I would have to, not main, but there's a theory called complex main, which contains not just the real numbers, but also the complex numbers. Now you can try and prove this goal. Oh, there's actually already a lemma that states exactly that. But if you didn't know that, then you could do this trick by simp. That won't do it, but if we go back to the slides will tell us how to do it. Here, numeral EQ suck was the thing that we need. I hate it. Simp. And now add numeral EQ suck. And now it can be proved. And if you had stated a wrong theorem, like x to the 4 is this cubed, it would still do something. And now it would actually you can see it failed to finish the proof, and in red you can see what was left over. It had reduced it down to x is equal to 0 or x is equal to 1, which is, of course, not provable. So it's doing something. Okay. Then I would like to move on and from automation move on to the very opposite, namely single-step proofs, where things are highly non-automatic, where you really, as a user, explicitly apply proof rules one by one. And you don't often have to do this, but sometimes it's helpful, and therefore I should introduce it. And, yep, it's typically when automation fails and you have to investigate why it failed, then you may have to apply some proof rules by hand and sort of get to the point where you can suddenly see, oh, yes, this is why it failed, because it got to a point where it needed some lemma. And, of course, with auto, it'll leave these things around, but if auto fails, then you may have to do this kind of thing. So first, there are these question mark variables. What are those? You don't type in question mark variables, but when you look at the lemma after it's been proved, it has those question mark variables in it. So the system will turn any free variable v in a theorem into question mark v. Now, logically, the two things are again the same. You're stating the same theorem. It's just an operational distinction. Here's an example of such a theorem, the theorem Conj I, which says that P, if you know P and you know Q, then you can deduce P and Q, the conjunction introduction theorem, that is. And why these question marks? The only point is that you give the system a hint and you say, I want to allow the system to instantiate those question mark variables with whatever concrete values are required when you apply the rule. And so logically it's the same, but operationally it says to the system, I'm now finished with the proof. Please, now when you want to use the rule, you're free to instantiate the variable. Of course, you don't, during the proof of the theorem, you don't want to instantiate the variable because then you would be proving something else. During the proof, they should stay fixed, and that's why that is called V. But afterwards, they become flexible in the sense that you can instantiate them with other values. This is if you know does anybody know the program in English Prolog? In Prolog, they would be called logical variables. So that's the same. They get instantiated by unification. And how do you instantiate them? You can do so by hand. So you can write conjunction introduction off, and then this. Now, that how this works will be... I'm surprised. Am I going to explain this later, or should I explain it now? I think I should explain it now. So what does this mean? This square bracket acts like an operator on this theorem. So you take that theorem and then you modify it using the operator little off and some arguments for that operator. So this is just a kind of funny syntax which you read from left to right. This is the argument, and this is the operation that you perform on the argument. And what does this operation do? It instantiates the question mark variables in your theorem, namely the P and the Q, and it does so from left to right. It goes through the theorem from left to right and instantiates it with these formulas. So it'll instantiate the first variable, the P, with the formula A equals B, and it'll instantiate the second variable, Q, with the formula false, and therefore you get a special version of this theorem that is where these arbitrary variables have been replaced by particular values, and now you get this more specific theorem instead of this very general theorem. So this is a sometimes helpful device for specializing your theorem, because what can happen is that your a proof method is not finding a proof because your theorem is too general, and if you were to replace some of the variables in the theorem by specific values specific for that proof situation, then the proof may go through automatically. So this is quite a helpful device in selective situations. So, but of course, it means you have to find out what are the right instantiations, and you have to write this this longish instantiation. That's why most of the time the instantiation is automatic, namely by unification. And what does that mean? It means that in the proof process, typically the conclusion of your rule will be unified with some formula. So this is the conclusion, and let's unify it with that formula. What does that mean? It means that the P is unified with A equals B, it becomes A equals B, and the Q is unified with false, Q becomes false. So that's the result of it. And unification is something that's part of the kernel of the system, and in trying to use proof rules, the system will perform unification, therefore find out how the variables in a proof rule need to be instantiated. And that's the heart of what is called rule application, where you apply a rule backwards. And let's just write down the rule that was here. No chalk? Not a single piece of chalk? Okay. I've got my own. Remind ourselves of this rule, conj I. And now you'll see an example of applying this rule backwards. So this is the, there it's again. This is a typical subgoal, a subgoal that ends in, that wants to prove A and B. And if I now apply this rule, what is happening is that the conclusion of the rule will be unified with the conclusion of the subgoal. So P will become A and Q will become B. And then we will replace the subgoal by the two assumptions or premises of the rule here. So you're using the rule backwards. You're saying, okay, I want to prove A and B. The rule tells me I can prove A and B if I can prove A and prove B. So the result will be two subgoals, A and B. And so that will be the result of first unifying these two formulas, the heads of the subgoal and the head of the rule, and then saying, okay, they match. And then you look at the premises, and the premises say, okay, now I have to prove A and I have to prove B, and you get two subgoals. And this is the general case. If you have a subgoal that ends in some conclusion C that you're trying to prove, and you're trying to apply some rule with the premises A1 to AN and conclusion A, what does that mean? It means you have to unify the A with the C. You have to see whether the rule fits onto your specific situation. So you unify A and C, and then you say, okay, now I can step backwards. I can, instead of trying to prove C, I can now prove A1 to AN. So you place C with these new subgoals, A1 to AN. Of course, that sounds like a bad deal. You're replacing one by many subgoals, but N could be zero, and then you're lucky you have replaced one by zero subgoals. And this is how you write it in Isabel. You just say apply rule and then the name of the rule. And then this process will be attempted by the system. It'll try and unify them. And if they don't unify, if your rule doesn't match what you're trying to prove, the system will just complain. And then if they could be unified, then it'll turn your one sub-goal that you had to see into these n sub-goals. Yeah.
So the x, y, z would be something like conjunction.
Introduction. And there you would just, you don't need the off. Now you can just say conj I because the unification will make the instantiation. That's precisely the difference. If you use the single rule application, then it'll pick up the unification will make the right instantiations. But sometimes you just want to say, oh, I think auto should be able to prove this. And you throw in some rule, say using, we haven't had that. Okay, so yeah, too early. Yeah, but sometimes just specializing rules is necessary, but if you apply them like this, it's not necessary. And this I will often call back chaining, because you go back when you use the rule, you say, okay, this is what I'm trying to prove, so let's try and prove that instead. Question about that whole idea of backchaining? These are typical backwards rules. If you apply them backwards, they decompose what you're trying to prove. Here the conjunction, the AND symbol is replaced by two separate sub-goals. Here with implication introduction, the implication of the logic HOL is replaced by this framework implication, and that means the system now has made the P an assumption and you're focusing your proof effort on Q. This is similar for the quantifier. There are, just like there are two implications, I will say more about that in a moment, there are two quantifiers. You should always use the ones with the single arrow and the upside down A, and these are part of the framework, and they're just there to make the whole framework to build up the framework, but they're not really something that you will use very much yourself. And here's another one, another introduction rule, the if introduction rule. If you have an equality between two propositions, P and Q, two Boolean formulas, then if you use this rule backwards, you will get two implications that you have to prove P implies Q, or rather you have to prove that assuming P, you can show Q, so P has already become an assumption, and here assuming Q, you have to prove P. And they're known as introduction rules because when you go from the above the line to below the line, they are known, they introduce the particular operator, the all, the imp, the if, and so on. This is a variant of this little off operator. So what did the little off operator do? It took your theorem and specialized some of the variables. That's all what it did. It put in specific values for the variables. Here was the example. There. You take a theorem and you specialize some of the variables in there with specific values, with specific formulas. And the big off is a variation of that. Let's just look at a simple special case. Let's let the rule R be a theorem of the form A implies B, and let S be another theorem that unifies with A. So R and S are the names of those theorems in Isabel, and A implies B is the actual theorem, not its name. And we don't need to know exactly what S looks like. It's just sufficient to say that it unifies with A. And then if you write R of S, then you're saying, please apply the R theorem to the S argument. So it's like an argument application. And now you should think of the R as a function that takes something of the form A and gives you back a B. And so the S is its argument. And if you apply R to S, it gives you back a B.
Well, it's not exactly B. It'll be some instance of B, because what will happen is that
the result of this thing is that you will unify the S, or the S is the name of the theorem, so you will unify the contents of S with A, and we claim here, we assume here, that that is unifiable, and then as a result you get the corresponding instance of B, because when you do the unification you will almost necessarily instantiate some of the variables in A, some of the question mark variables, and those question mark variables may also appear in B, so the result of this is a special version of the B that was specialized by the unification of the S theorem with the premise A. And here's an example. This is your theorem that you start from, and now you want to, in a forward direction, apply an implication. And the implication that you're applying is the one in conjunction introduction. This is conjunction introduction, so it's an implication. And in fact, if you write it out in its proper form without the abbreviation, then it looks like this. So this is just a nicer syntax for this. And so now we have exactly the situation that we have in the line above here, in the beginning of the slide. Your theorem, your first theorem R, the conjunction introduction, is a theorem of something implies something. And now you want to apply this in a forward direction to the result of, so here the S isn't just an atomic theorem, but it's again the result of a little computation, namely REFL of A. So first, what is the result of this here, REFL of A?
A equals A.
Right. And what happens now, that you try to unify that theorem that you have here with the premise of your implication. The premise of your implication is just a variable, so that's very easy to unify. In fact, this variable will be instantiated by A equals A. And the premise disappears, because the result is the theorem obtained by proving A with S. So you're proving the P with your theorem that you have, A equals A, and so you have proved the premise, and so as a result, you get the conclusion. So that's what's left over. Each RS will get rid of one of the premises. You have to prove the premise. Here it's a very trivial proof. And then what you get given is the conclusion. So what would be the result of this whole expression here? That's not a terribly useful example, but it's just there to demonstrate what's going on. So try to match that, and if you find you don't quite see what the why that should be the result of this expression, I can go through it once more. Yeah.
Could you explain the unification part again?
The unification just means you have two expressions, and you basically put them on top of each other, and whenever there is a variable in one part and a larger expression in the other part, that variable will be made equal to that other So it's a fairly, you can directly just, sometimes it's called pattern matching, but that's a very general expression. And you're just trying to figure out how to instantiate the question mark variable so that the two things become equal. And here, of course, it's a particularly simple example. You just need to instantiate that variable by that expression here. Yeah?
I have a question again. Because why is the premise then not part anymore?
That's precisely because we are not just instantiating a theorem, we're actually performing a proof step, a forward proof step. And we're saying, please use this theorem R and prove the premise of theorem R with S and give me back the conclusion. So here you've actually, you've combined two theorems. It's like a simple forward step in a proof from A to B. And that's precisely, then you need to remember that the both of them are, in some sense, the off means it's an application, you apply something to something, but in the first kind of application, it's just you instantiate with a little f, you instantiate variables, and otherwise the structure remains the same. In the second kind, with this big off, you really perform a proof step, and you basically get rid of one of the first of the assumptions. And this is the general case if you have, as you do here you have, in fact, multiple assumptions. So we could write conj I off and then have two theorems that would get unified with a P and unified with a Q, and then you would be given this. So maybe there's an example here. Yes, so again, what is the result of this? So this is very much like the previous example, but instead of stopping here, you have a second theorem. So now the idea is you have to prove both of the premises of conj I with these two theorems. And then what is the result? Yeah, precisely, because what you've done, you can actually think of this as being done in two separate steps. You perform first the step that we already did, and then we get this out, and then you perform another step off, and now, well, raffle little off B equals B. Yes. So that gives you the theorem B equals B, and then you apply this rule forward to it, so you unify the B equals B with the Q, and thus you have proved it, and then you are left with this instance A equals A and B equals B. And it would be terrible if you had to do all your proofs in this style. In principle, you could. You could all by hand combine all of the proof rules step by step, but that would take you forever. So this is really just in special cases where the system isn't able to figure out how to plug things together, and then you can give it a little bit of help. A typical example is you may have an induction hypothesis, which is an implication itself. And then it can be helpful to first prove the left side of the implication, and then apply the induction hypothesis and then get the conclusion of that and then work from that. Yeah. From now on, I will actually mostly suppress, as I have already done, the question mark. The question mark is really just an operational hint to the system. Feel free to instantiate those variables, for example, by unification, but it's logically it doesn't give you any new information. And so let's conclude today with the single step demo, which I think is not going to show much new.
single step demo. So here are just, again, examples of instantiation of variables by specific values. So let's just look at the first one. This is conj introduction of A and B. So you've just, instead of the P and Q, you know which are, in fact, the P and the Q were question mark variables. Now the A and the P, B, they are free variables. You can't instantiate them any further. And if you just instantiate one of them, it just goes through from left to right. And here, the first one it hits is the P, and that gets instantiated. The Q is not instantiated. If you want to instantiate only the second variable, so only the Q, what you can do is you can write this line here. Then the P will be left alone because the underscore is not going to do anything. That's the hint, or that's the way of expressing this. And then only the B gets substituted for the Q. So there are some variations. You can even use names. So you can say conjunction introduction where Q is equal to B, which is quite readable. And then you get, again, the last of the theorems above, where the P has been left alone and only the Q has been instantiated. And here are the examples that we already saw, so I don't think I want to go through those again with the off. We had gone through them on the board. And here is a simple example of a backward proof. So here's the lemma that you're trying to prove. Never mind the fact that it's already in the system. So this is what you're trying to prove. And you should tell me now, what do you think is going to happen if I say apply rule conj i? What will the proof state look like afterwards? Yeah? Right. Yes, almost. There's a little bit missing. Yes. So the premises that you have here, they are not affected by this step. That means they persist. They don't get lost. So you will still have the two assumptions here, but you have now split up the conjunction into the two subgoals. So afterwards, and then there is the proof method assumption. So if you say apply assumption, it'll just check whether the conclusion of your proof goal is amongst the assumptions and then prove it. Okay, I think that brings me almost to the end. Yes, so you may be wondering, why are these two arrows there? I tried to explain this arrow is part of the framework, and its purpose is to structure theorems and also to structure the proof states into things that are assumptions and the thing that you really focus on, the conclusion. And whereas this one is part, not of the framework, but it's part of a very rich logic, HOL, and this can now also occur in the middle of arbitrary formulas and not just at the top level where you say, here we have some assumption, then there's a conclusion. And so when you state your formulas, when you state your lemmas, you should always state the lemmas in this form. But if you have more implications inside A, maybe hidden inside further operators, then you will have to use this. So this is really something that gives you something of type bool back, whereas this is not, it doesn't return something of type bool, but of another type. So do phrase your theorems like this.
and not like this, although logically the two things can be converted to each other, but operationally, using the machinery of the system, this is the one that's nicer to handle. So, for example, if you write it like this, then you can use the apply rule method, and then it'll say, oh yeah, what I've got is an implication, so I want to unify with the tip, with the conclusion. Whereas if you try to use apply rule with this one, then it'll try to unify the whole thing with whatever you have. And so that's the main difference. And really, that's the end for today. And what will happen next week is we will move on to the proof language ESA that allows you to write proofs that actually where the structure of the proof is clearly expressed, and but where you as a user have to give the individual structuring, and it's not everything just by auto. But yeah, that's for next week. Thanks. Any last question? We still have a couple of minutes, so if you have some really open questions, we can go through it. If not, then see you next week. Thank you.